Okay, good afternoon to everyone. Just a brief introduction before we start. My name is Avram David Karnowski. I am a Kollel alumni. Still go there a little bit in the afternoons, however long they let me in for. And I want to thank Rabbi Heyman, Rabbi Summers, who is here, and everyone who arranged this beautiful thing. It's a very inspiring thing to see on a Wednesday afternoon, so many people coming to share words of Torah. So, I used to live on the west side, now I live on the east side. I'm the rabbi of a shul called Esh Kodesh, if any of you have heard of that. And what we're going to talk about is a fascinating topic, which I'm excited to discuss. And those of you who know me, I say this always at the beginning of my class, and then I take it back in the middle. I always say that I want to hear as much interaction from everybody as possible. And then in the middle, when I can't get in a word edgeways, I'm like, oh, I didn't take that back. So let's have, but I'm still going to say it again. Let's have interaction. Let's discuss it together. There's no set amount of material that we need to do. We could expand it. We could zoom in on one area. Let's see where this takes us. Okay, let us begin. So the name of this class is A Divine Blueprint from 6 days of creation to 6,000 years. So let's start. If you take the source sheet that's in front of you, we're going to take a look, and this is going to be the foundation of what we're going to be talking about. Take a look at the first quote over there, which is a quote from Talmud, Gemara, Sanhedrin, 97a. Sadi Zion Amad Aleph. Right on the top over there, on the first page, you can look at it in the Hebrew or in the English. And the quote is like this. I'm going to read the English. Rav Katina says, 6,000 years is the duration of the world, and it is in ruins for 1,000 years. The duration of the period during which the world is in ruins is derived from a verse as is stated in Isaiah, and the Lord alone should be exalted on that day. And the day of God lasts 1,000 years. So what do we have over here? Let's try and unpack what we've just read, because it's already a little bit of a bombshell. What our sages are teaching us in the name of the Talmudic sage Rav Katina is that the world as we know it is going to exist for a total of 6,000 years. Now, where are we up to right now in that count of 6,000? 5783. So that means according to the calculation of the Gemara, how many years do we have left of this world the way we know it? 217. Right, 5783, we're halfway through that, a little bit over half. So the world as we know it, according to the Talmud, we are literally at the tail end of these 6,000 years, and there are 213 years left of the world, the way you look around, the way you see it. This is how it's going to look for another 213 years, which is, wow. Now, what's going to be after 6,000 years? Let's just say our great-grandchildren. You know, where are they going to be as this world transitions at the end of 6,000 and onwards? What's it going to look like? So the quote that we just read is that after that, the world is going to be in ruins. The world is going to be destroyed for 1,000 years. Now, question for you. What's going to happen to the people? What's going to happen to the world? First of all, what does it mean that... Let's ask a few questions. Number one, what is the significance? Why 6,000 years? Number two, why is there going to be 1,000 years of ruin, of destruction? Number three, what exactly are we supposed to do if we happen to be alive during those 1,000 years of destruction? The world's going to cease to exist. Everything's going to stop. Where do we go? What is the game plan? I don't think it's relevant to us. We should all live until 120, even if you want to live until 200, right, we're still not going to hit there. So this is for the coming generations.
We're going to Mars according to certain high-level tycoons.
Very good. Very good. And Mars is... But by the way, on a serious note, Mars is probably included in this. When we talk about the world as ceasing to exist, it doesn't just mean Earth. It means everything. The whole creation, yes. I wouldn't say... I can't prove that to you this minute, but I would not have thought that it means just Earth. I think it would mean the whole system, entire system of creation. the galaxies, the planets, the sun, everything that we have should cease to exist. So that's what we want to figure out. 6,000 years, what is that 1,000 years of ruin all about? What's going to happen to people during the 1,000? We'll see what we have time to get through. So one more quote over here, let's just read. Actually, let's hold off on that quote. So here is the foundation of what we're going to talk about. Our sages reveal, namely Ramban, who is Nachmanides. He was one of the earlier commentators on the Torah. He lived, I believe, in the 1100s. Around that, maybe the end of the 1000s or beginning of the 12, but somewhere around the 1100s. He's called one of the Rishonim. And interestingly enough, the Ramban, just a little side note over here, we have today access to the Zohar, to esoteric teachings, what we call the Kabbalah. The generations for many, many, many years did not have any access to the Zohar. Even though it was written by Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who lived in the year, I believe, in the 200s it was. So the Zohar was hidden for many, many years. It was revealed in the times of the Ramban. So the Ramban, Nachmanides, is one of the first ones that had access to what we call today Kabbalistic teachings. If anyone's familiar with the Ramban, Maimonides clearly did not have any access to Kabbalistic teachings. And Maimonides is very busy with philosophy and trying to work through Torah that way. In the end of the Rambam's life, Kabbalah was revealed, and it was very questionable. It was like, what is this thing? We don't know what it is. We don't necessarily have a tradition and what to do with it. So that you'll see a big difference in Rambam to Ramban based on their exposure to Kabbalistic teachings and based on the lack of exposure. So Ramban had a student whose name was Rabbeinu Bachai. Ramban and Rabbeinu Bachai is going to be the foundation of everything we're saying right now. They say like this, the world was created in how many days? 6 days. Did anyone say seven? Right, I mean, it's interesting because we have 7 days, but the days of creation were six. Six were the days of creation. The world was created in 6 days. And they're going to make a connection that every day correlates to 1,000 years of world history. So that means that we have the world, as the Talmud teaches us, for 6,000, 6 days of creation, 6,000 years. That means every day equals 1,000 years. If you take a look, and if we go into a little bit of detail, what happened on day one of creation, we're going to find the core historical events that took place in the first 1,000 years of our history. If we dive into day two, we'll see until the year 2000. And here comes the exciting part. If we dive into day six, we will actually be able to see something in the future. Because we're not at the end of six yet. So if we look at day six, it should be able to tell us something that should happen all the way until the end, which is even past the date that we're talking today. Day number seven. What happened on day number seven in creation?
God rested.
God rested. What does that correlate to? The 1,000 years of ruin. Now that is mind-boggling. That means what we're saying is that Shabbos, which is our favorite day of the week, that correlates to 1,000 years of desolation. How do we figure that one out? If we would have to guess what would happen during the 1,000 years which correlate to the day of Shabbos, I would have said it's a day of a lot of eating challah, or you know, a lot of festivities, family time, the world as we know it in a very beautiful way. Instead, the 1,000 years that correlates to the day of Shabbos, which is the most sublime day of the week, is 1,000 years of ruin. We'll see if we have time to talk about that. But that's a question that needs to be figured out. So what we're going to do right now is if you turn to page 2, we're going to see over there a basic timeline of the 6 days of creation. If you look on page 3, we'll see a Jewish history timeline, and we're going to flip back and forth and see together if we can match up and see an understanding of how one matches up to 1,000, 2 to 2,000, 3 to 3,000, all the way until we get to the time period that we're living in right now. And let's do this together. So let's go to day one. What was the core event that happened on the first day of creation?
What year?
like he are. Let there be light. Right? There are some chumashim around the table. If anyone wants to look in more detail, I just did it in very short over here. And thank you to Chabad.org for much of the resource that I printed over here. So on the first day, God said, let there be light, and there was light. So the world was desolate. There was nothing in it. The world was literally barren. And it may look very similar to the way it will look during the 7,000 years. There's nothing there. Hashem comes and he utters the words, let there be light, and there was light. So the core thing that took place in day one is light. Now, a side note over here. Where did this light come from? Think about this before you answer. Where did this light come from on day one? Could it have been the sun? Why can't it be? It can't be the sun. Why can't it be the sun? Right. There's no sun. Look over here on day four, the fourth day, God made the sun, the moon, and the stars to shed light upon the earth. So what is the light of day one? There's no, the light, the way we know it, comes from the sun. So what does it mean that we have light on day one?
The original light.
What, Bob, do you want to... how would you describe that? How would you understand that?
A light of righteousness?
Well, where would it emanate from?
So it comes from Hashem, but Hashem removes a piece of materialized in a certain sense, but not really material, but removes a piece of self and sends it into the creation.
Right. Hashem is the source of light. Anything associated with God is light. And when he reveals himself, so to speak, but an emanation that comes out, that's going to be light from the original source. The sun, it's an amazing thing. The light that we have from the sun is actually a very downgraded light. It's not the real thing. It's almost like having a flashlight as opposed to having the entire room lit up. Right? The sun is like a flashlight. Pretty powerful one. It does a fantastic job. But it's really a flashlight, shining light on a certain thing. But when the light of day one was not, here's the sun and let it shine light, everything was just open. Inherently, the room was lit up with a floodlight. That is the light of day one. Now, let us figure out, who is the dominant person in the first 1,000 years of creation? 930 years of Adam. Now, so it's interesting. So you would say the dominant person, Adam, there we go. His name is Adam, by the way. He's got a little bias over here. So you're saying that Adam was dominant. Any sense?
He was the first Baal Tshuva.
I like that. So Adam was the dominant person. He lived for 930 years. Now, this almost matches up with the 1,000. Now, who could help us with why it really does match up with the 1,000? That means Adam was the dominant... Well, let's back up. Let's go step by step. Adam was the dominant man of the first 1,000 years of creation. The creation of man, says the Ramban, says Nachmanides, Am Rabbeinu Bachai, is the introduction of light into the world. Because the way that Hashem's light comes into this world is through the human being. And when God created us, created man, Adam, the original man, which had in it all the souls of all the human beings, at that point, he's going to be the one to shed light into creation. So God said, let there be light. What happened was, for the first 1,000 years, there was a man that came and for most of it shed light onto creation. But he only lived for 930 years. So why didn't we have a full 1,000? Why didn't Adam live for a full 1,000 years? He gave 70 to David. That means that really, Adam did live for 1,000 years. Except that he took off 7 years of his life and he gave them over to King David. And King David lived for exactly 70 years to the day. Which is an amazing thing. So Adam and David together fill up the full 1,000 years. I'm going to share with you something beautiful. How do we see that? Well, let's go like this. Who's going to be which important player in history is going to be a descendant of King David?
Moshiach.
Now take the word Adam. Take the word Adam in Hebrew. Now, the word Adam in Hebrew, let's spell it out in the Hebrew letters. Can anyone do this? In the Hebrew letters for the word Adam. It starts with an Aleph. Then we have a Dalet. And then we have a Mem. That's Adam. Aleph, a Dalet, and a Mem. Now listen to this. Aleph. Adam is Alex. Dalet stands for David, King David. And Mem stands for Mashiach. For the Messiah. So in the word Adam, you really have this span of history. Just in that one word. Adam, 930 years. Dalet is for David, the other 70 years of his life. Down to the Mem, which is going to be the culmination of history of this world, which is going to be Mashiach.
Why did David need to borrow 70 years from all his life?
It's an excellent question. I'll answer you in short, but it really needs a full Torah for Tycoons. So I'll answer you in short. David was born, and he wasn't supposed to, he didn't have any of his own life. He was supposed to be born and die right away. He didn't have any life. He had no life of his own. Now why is it like that? Why was, so Hashem gave him 7 years of, Adam gave him 7 years of his life. Now why was David, why did Hashem do such a thing? That David should be created with no life of his own. So again, I'm going to say this in short. The essence of a true Jewish leader is that it's not about me. It's about reflecting God's light into the world. Our style of leadership is that I'm the leader. If you want to be a Jewish king, it's just the opposite. My leadership is that it's not me. I'm going to point you to the source. That's going to be my leadership. I'm going to take everyone in the world and I'm going to show you that it's all God and it's not me. So his essence was based on a foundation that he didn't have any of his own life. That's who David was. We could talk a lot about it. If, in another 20 seconds, if you take the word David itself, Dalet, Vav, Dalet. Dalet means poor in Hebrew. Dalus means poor. And he has a Dalet at the beginning and a Dalet at the end. That means that the Vav in the middle brought it down. But whatever he did, he stayed. His ego was non-existent. It was all about Hashem's light flowing through him, but it wasn't me. And therefore Hashem created his essence as not having any of his own life. Because that was really his definition. I don't know if I just made any sense, but to be continued, if that's okay. So like this. That's day one. Let there be light, Adam, which is basically 1,000 years, and then we come to day two. Yes, Bob?
Wasn't Adam supposed to live forever?
It's a valid point. That's a very, very excellent question. That means Adam, if he wouldn't have sinned, was supposed to live forever. Now, what would have happened if Adam would have lived forever? I mean, what would have happened to the world as we know it? How long would the world have gone for? How would it have all played out? That's all for the next Torah for Tycoons. That's an excellent question to figure out. What would happen if Adam would live forever? Would this world turn into the world to come? Would it still take 6,000 years? Would there be other humans if Adam wouldn't have sinned? Possibly not. Possibly it would have been just Adam. Because really, we're all included in him. We only got broken up because of the sin into 600,000 pieces. So it could be that there would have been no humanity besides for Adam. So it's a good point, but what we're going to talk about today is from the assumption of Adam's sin and on. But it's a very valid thing what you're bringing up. Let's go on to day two. What happened on day two? What was the dominant thing that took place in day two of creation? Anyone? Day two of creation. What happened? Take a look at the source sheet over here. What was the dominant thing that took place on day two? Day one, we have light, and then comes along day two. Day two, if you take a look on the second page, on the second day, God made the sky and called it heaven. So there's really a separation at this point between the heavens and the earth. Because on day one, there's no separation. Everything is just nothingness with light in it. There's no up there and down here. There's no heaven and earth. On day two, God made a separation, which is beautiful to take note. Why was separation created on day two? Because the first number that's a separation, by definition, is two. Right? One is unity. Two is when that one becomes into two. So on that day was where it was introduced into creation, the concept of a separation. Because until then, everything was one. Isn't that beautiful? Day two, the number two itself, is a separation. And that's the day that God introduced into the world, the first separation that there ever was.
What was the day?
At that point, that's another good question. We're out of business. There's no sun and there's no moon and there's no day and there's no night the way we know it. So how do we define a day? That's a very, very big topic. Ramban does talk about it. But for now, we're going to say it's 24 hours without a sun and a moon dictating that. But it is a 24-hour period for today's discussion. We're going to go with it being a 24-hour period. How do you figure out hours and all that? It's all good questions. What? So day two, we have a separation. Some water goes up there, some water stays down here, and we have the separation between the two. What was the dominant thing that took place after year 1,000 of creation? Let's take a look at what we have over here. Who's introduced? So we have year one on the third page is creation of the world. 930, Adam died, which we spoke about, is 930, sort of 1,000. 1,056 into creation of the world, Noah is born. Noah starts to build the ark, and then in the year 1656, we have the great flood that covered the earth. So we have a lot of stuff with water. The flood literally destroyed the world the way we know it. And what took place on that day was the first separation that there was between two people. No, the world's going to be destroyed. Noah and his family are going to go into the ark and be separated from the destruction of the world. And be saved. And that's the first point in history where we have that there's one part of the world's going one way, another part of the world's going a different way. The world's destroyed, Noah and his family are in the ark and they're separated. Coming from day two being the day of separation. Separating heaven and earth, the water goes up. In the dominant thing of the from in the year 1656, which is in the right bang in the middle of from the year 1000 to 2000 is a flood, water going all over the place, and a separation. The world goes this way, Noah and his family go a different way. Now let's get into day three. This is where it gets exciting. Day three, what took place? What took place in day three? And here we're going to go in two different directions. On day three, we have a lot of stuff. The way they write it over here, God put the earth into good shape. At his command, the waters of the earth gathered at certain places. The waters formed seas and oceans, lakes and rivers, so that in other parts, the dry land became visible. So that means the earth is starting to take formation into having dry land, places where things could grow. At God's further command, the earth was made to produce all kinds of plants, grass, trees, shrubs, and flowers. So it's the beginning of growth. Day one, unity, light. Day two, separation of waters. Day three, we're introduced to the concept of growth. Who is the individual in creation that we could say this, who caused the biggest growth to the Jewish people? It was an individual who affects every single one of us until today.
Avraham Avinu.
Forefather. Avram is the first one of the forefathers. He, what did he spend his life doing? What did Avram Avinu spend his life doing?
Teaching people.
Made converts. He brought everyone into Torah. He brought them. He had an open home. He brought them in. He taught them how to make blessings over their food. He pretty much, what you see around here is, he had an open house. And he did this literally all day. He sat at the table and he spoke words of Torah. And he made them believe in God, and he discovered God. And he literally made the growth into the world. Now here's the problem. Here is the big problem. Take a look at page 3. What year? I'm telling you right now that Avram is the dominant person from 2000 until 3000. What year was Avram born?
52 years before.
He's born in the year 1948. So I'm out of business. I'm wrong. I'm telling you that Avram is the person that's making it go on day three from 2000 to 3000. If that would be true, wouldn't he be born in the year 2000 or on? But he was born in 1948. Any thoughts on this question? Why would it be that he would be born in the year 1948 if his dominance is from the year 2000 and on.
His functioning role started, let's say, in the year 2000.
Right. Right, that is true. That means he didn't, according to many opinions, he only discovered God at the age of, really, that was the age of, what do you say? Three, what's the other? There's another opinion. Yeah, which I think is 48. So really, that's the year 1996. It almost gets us there. It almost gets us there. I mean, the year when he started maybe doing things and teaching was in that year. But I'll tell you, anybody else want to suggest something? Why he would be born early as opposed to in the year 2000 and on? I'll tell you what Nachmanides says. I'll tell you what the Ramban says. This is a fundamental thing that he reveals over here, which is going to give us another window into the future. He says, any time period that starts, there's always winds of it that take place at the end of the earlier time period. So that means, just like we understand, for example, the morning doesn't just come. It starts off slowly. There's a little bit of light. From midnight and on, really, even though we can't see it, but from midnight and on, there's really things are being put in motion for the day to come. Now, we only see it when the sunrise. But way before that, it's already starting. So the Ramban says that already at the end of one period, God is stirring the winds to set up history for the next period. So Avram was born early, and he's going to be mostly active in 2000 and on, like you said. But he's born before because God will always put into place early, at the end of the last day, what will take place in the next day. If we do the math, what that should tell us is that in this time period where we are right now, which is at the end of the 6,000 year period, there should be already things coming into the world which should be reminiscent of what's going to come. That should be. And it's a mind-blowing concept if you start to think about it, of certain winds that come into the world. From one of my teachers, I heard it, that they come into the world early, but they get taken the wrong way. So, without going more into that, but just think about it as a concept of things that will come into the world are likely already here in some form, because they're getting ready for daybreak, which is going to be at the end of the year 6,000. Things are already going to be put into motion at the end of this period of 5,000 years, 6,000 years, which we're in now, for what will come for the next period. I mean, something's already here. You're already going to start to feel something of messianic times almost already now, even though we'll get to that in a minute. So Avram is there, and he's the one that brought people in. He brought growth into the world. What else took place in the year between 2000 and 3000? Something that we cannot forget about. Akedas Yitzchak, yes. Right? Akedas Yitzchak, true. Tell me something else, something huge. Right? And what else? Keep on going.
Torah.
Yes.
Everything.
Everything, that's right.
We're
right in the middle of that. That's right. The giving of the Torah was given in the year 2448. In a couple weeks, we're going to be at Shavuot, which is going to be the day the Torah was given. What does the Torah have to do with growth? Around day three, things started to take form on earth, and things started growing. What does Torah have to do with growth? Right, right. This is what gives us our tools to be able to live a life of growth,
right,
as opposed to just coasting through. Torah gives us 613 solutions in how to live a life of growth,
right,
and not just a life of growth, but to bring out our potential, who we are. So we have Avram and we have Torah, all in the year 2000, 3000, two fundamental things in the concept of growth, all to do with day three. Let us move on now to day four. What happened in day four of creation? On the fourth day, as we mentioned before, we're introduced to the sun, the moon, the stars, to shed light upon the earth. And then he set a time for day and a time for night, which is what we mentioned before, the weeks, the months, the year, four seasons, everything is being introduced on day four. So the big thing that took place is light, the way we know it, the system we know it, light is being shed on the earth from the sun, the moon, and the stars. What was the period of history that we lived in from the year 3000 to 4000. What do we have from 3000? Let's take a look on and see what we have over here.
Golas, I mean, this is the time of Golas.
So Golas is really, we're going to get to Golas in the next period. You're right about Golas, but keep on going. It means something before Golas. Well, you're focusing on what we don't have. What do we have? Well, Marshall, what were you saying?
We're divided.
Again, let's. I mean, first of all, we have the king, the Jewish king, the first Jewish kings, which is in. I mean, let's go from David. David became king in the year 2892. Solomon became king in the year 2924. The building of the first Beis Hamikdash 2928. It was completed 2935, and then we have. The Beis HaMikdash is around. It's destroyed in year 3338. That means the dominant time of Beis HaMikdash, of having temple, is in the year 3000. Take note again. When did all this start? That means the dominant thing that we're going to talk about for now, of from 3000 to 4000, is the first temple and the second temple. You're correct that in the middle there was destruction and exile, but we came back. And for most of that, we had some form of temple. We had Jewish kings, we had David, we had Solomon, David and Shlomo, and we had a first temple and a second temple. But when did the first temple start becoming built? This was in the year 2928. You see the same pattern. You see the Ramban's pattern again. How things started to be set into place for the year 3000, already the end of the last year. Ramban says every day you're going to see this pattern. What's going to come is going to start already at the end of the last thing. So we have the Beis HaMikdash. Now let's do some thinking over here. We have two Beis HaMikdash. What could they line up to? We have the first temple. Which one was greater? The first temple or the second temple?
First
one, by far. Second temple was nowhere close to the level of revelation that we had than the first temple. What could that line up to what we just mentioned took place in day four? Sun and the moon. Sun is the dominant light that we have. The moon reflects that light. The other way the commentaries say it is we have two Torahs. We have the written Torah and we have the oral Torah. The written Torah is what God gave us. It's all open. The oral Torah is what we need to figure out on our own. The moon receives its light from the sun, and it has to be a receiver to reflect it. The first Beis HaMikdash was a time of open revelation. It was almost like the sun. Everything was out there. It was written Torah. You didn't have to believe in God. You have to believe in God. You didn't need proofs to believe in God. God was right there in front of you. Right? As if any of you are familiar with David Sachs, who was in Denver a couple of months ago, he sat over imagine a conversation between two fish who are having a conversation with each other. Do you believe in water? Right? Do you believe in water? And one fish says to the other, you know, my grandfather told me that water exists, and therefore I believe in water. Right? And you look at them and you say, you're living water, you're breathing water. This is your everything that's around you. God is, when God reveals himself, he's all around us. We don't need proofs and beliefs and systems to prove it. You're literally swimming in an ocean of divinity as we talk. And when they had a first Beis HaMikdash, the sun was out. Hashem was everywhere. There were open miracles. 10 miracles took place every single day in the Beis HaMikdash. Second Beis HaMikdash, things were already toned down. Things were already very, very different then. We didn't have the Aron, we didn't have, right? Everything was very, very different. But we were still able to draw light and reflect it. Just like the moon is able to draw light from the sun and reflect outwards. Let's move on to day five. What happened on day five? Day five, the world is already, it's got seasons. It's already has a day and a night, sun and a moon. And on day five, God already starts filling the seas with fish. So we're introduced to fish. Things are already alive, living creations in the water and other water animals into the air above us. We have birds and we have things that, animals that are related to water. That is what we have on day five. Now this one's going to be a little bit of a hard one. Day five, we have this, the sea is, fish are introduced, fish are created, other water animals, and we have birds that are flying around. This is going to be a little bit harder. What took place? What was What situation were we in the entire 1,000 year from 4,000 to 5,000?
What situation were we in?
The Jewish people.
Galus.
It's the only time period in history, literally the only one where we're going to be in exile for the full 1,000 years. Because Mashiach needs to come before the end of 6,000 years. Guaranteed. It may be a moment before, it may be 212 years before, or anywhere in between, or more than that, or 200, whatever, up until the point where we are today. But Mashiach must come before the end, so we are guaranteed that we will not be in exile in the year 5 to 6 for a full 1,000 years. The only time in history where we're in exile for a full 1,000 years was from 4,000 to 5,000. You never have anybody some Mikdash. Take a look at the what we had over here. We had, and again, the destruction. When did the destruction start? 3829. Again, at the end of the period of the last one, it already started. The entire 4,000 years is destruction. Now, what does being in exile destruction have anything to do with fish and water animals and birds? This is a tough one.
I think it's showing different empires and societies and things like that.
That's right. That's right. Very good. Well said, Alex. Well said. There are different empires and different forces in the world where the human being, or at least the Jew, is not really in control. That means the definition of a Jew in exile is that we are not necessarily free to do our agenda the way we want to do it. Again, to be clear, we live in a wonderful country where we are free to do all the mitzvahs, but we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, and we don't have Mashiach, and that means that we're inherently capped from reaching, we can't go past a certain place. There's a certain limit to how far we can go as people. Until Mashiach comes, until we get our Beis HaMikdash, the third one back. And the concept of fish and birds flying around represents other empires being in control, and not allowing the human being to be dominant necessarily in its agenda. When we say the human being, we mean the Jew in the sense of being the person that will spread the most of God's light into this world. So, we're introduced basically to the concept of animals, and that means that there's going to be other things in the world that are going to be controlling us and controlling the world in a way that will not allow God's light to be revealed in the way that He wants it to be.
Right.
So that would be the year 4,000 to 5,000.
I would suggest something slightly different, which is that also that both situations were not home. Neither of those animals are in the proper place.
Well, beautiful.
The birds and they're also flying.
Beautiful.
They're not at rest in their vacation.
They're not in the, yeah. I don't remember who says who. Ramban says one, what I just said, and Rabbeinu Bachai says the other. He brings a pasuk that we are compared, thank you for reminding me. We are compared to fish of the sea. What Rabbi Haman is saying is that fish in the sea are almost like homeless. They're just swimming around without anywhere to go, basically. They haven't carved out any turf almost. They're just swimming, millions and probably billions of fish, which are just hanging around in the sea. And they have a whole empire going on, don't get me wrong. But we, during exile, are just like fish in the sea. We don't have a home. We don't have a place. We don't have dry land. We don't have a way of moving forward almost. We stay where we are. So on the one hand, it represents other empires being in control. On the other hand, it represents us being like the fish that we lack the control and we lack the space and we lack the home. Thank you. So that would be, go ahead.
In the water are in a perfect environment. They don't need anything. They have everything they need to subsist and all that. And same with the birds in the sky. So it seems to me they're in a better place.
Yeah, so let me respond to you. Let me respond to you. You're asking an excellent question. It's, again, I would say a longer topic, but let me tell you my thoughts. How would we define what's a better place? Right, you're bringing, what's your name?
Josie.
Josie, thank you. It's a great question. So, being in a better place, right, I said this to somebody literally yesterday who was complaining to me about their situation. Again, it was without any context. Without any context. They were complaining about their situation. And I said to them, do you know what would have been an even better situation for you, literally the best situation for you, would be not to be born. Why? You can't go wrong. You can't go wrong if you're not born, right? There's no trouble, there's no sorrows, there's no one dies, there's no one to deal with, right? There's, everything is great if we're not born. So what we're going to have to say is that, I think maybe I overheard you say that word, a safe place. Is that what you said? Right, you could be in a safe place. Doesn't mean you're in the best place. The best place for growth is in a place where you could build something. So, where we could build something. Building something means that we can make mistakes, means that there's going to be pain, there's going to be suffering, there's going to be hurt, there's going to be destruction. But it means that we could build. On the other hand, being in a place where you have everything, imagine you'd be brought up in a way that you never had to work a day in your life and you're literally just taken care of. You don't need to get out of bed.
Like the womb of the mother.
Like the womb of the mother. All said. Right, it's a safe place. Be in the mother's. What do you say? Yeah. Never had to do anything. So, what would you do? What would you do? And what would you define such a life as? It's a life of safe. It's beautiful. It's pretty relaxing. But that's not.
Those are the most angry people you'll ever meet.
When they don't. Wait, we need to do this. Now let's move it back to Torah. Let's move it back to Torah. So let's get it back to days of creation and the 1,000-year period that we're talking about. So what we have is a life of growth, a life where we could build something, is always going to be out of the ocean. We need to go back to the ocean to get our breath. Torah is compared to the ocean. But we need to live in this world and we need to build something for ourselves. We need to be vulnerable and have a space in order to make a life for ourselves, right? Okay, thank you. Okay, so let us get to, we have 15 minutes left. I think we're, yeah, go ahead, Bob.
But being fruitful and multiplying, I mean, isn't that pretty good? That alone, maybe? Could be enough.
To answer what? Well, what are you referring to with
that? That's all you need to do, be fruitful and multiply. That would be the growth. Or the animals, for sure.
Yeah, that's definitely growth. Yeah, I mean, that could be done in so many different ways. I mean, but again, you need to be out of the ocean to be able to do that. You need to be able to build something for yourself. Out of the ocean is a place where everything just swims. Everything is fine over there.
Obviously, spend much time in the ocean.
When I say ocean in this sense, what we mean is the ocean is a place of the closest thing that we have in this world to lack of form. Water. When we're defining water.
Take you back to the pelagic column and explain to you that the ocean is extremely formal, aside from what you're saying.
If you take a cup of water and leave it without putting it into a cup, what's going to happen to it?
Evaporate.
It's going to evaporate. It's going to go. It's going to spill. It's not going to hold on to its shape. It's a little bit of a long discussion, but when we're comparing water to dry land, we're going to be saying that water in its nature has in it something which wants to just move and not stay in a certain still form, as opposed to things on the dry land are going to stay in a formed creation. That's going to be a definition between water and dry land.
Well, they don't stay that way forever, though.
They're not going to stay that, because nothing in this world is going to stay.
100%.
100%. Nothing in this world is going to last like that forever. Go ahead.
Fish in the sea and birds in the sky are living beings that are both in environments that human beings can't survive in.
Well said.
Being in Golis is a state of being, but not thriving. We don't survive in Golis the way we would.
It's not a long-term plan.
Yeah. We're not.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Beautifully said. Beautifully said. Couldn't have said it better. Thank you. Okay, we have a couple of minutes left, and I don't want to not get to day 6 and day 7. So, let us move right along. I'm happy to take any questions, discuss more after we're done. So, let's get to day 6. What happened on day 6? What took place on day 6 of creation? Something happened before that.
Animals.
Thank you.
The
behemoths, right. First, we have animals are created all the way at the beginning of the morning. And the commentators actually say that the animals were created before daybreak. Animals were created early in the morning before sunrise. And then after that, Adam was created with Samras. Animals and Adam, the first human being, is created on day six. What does that tell us about the year from the period of time from 5,000 to 6,000? So the commentaries say like this. They say that the beginning of 5,000 is going to be a time of where literally animals are let loose. It's going to be a terrible period in the Jewish people's history. And you can look at, I put on one thing over here, but literally in the year 5012, right at the beginning of 5000 is when the Inquisition began, the Spanish Inquisition began, you know, torture and the burning of Jews, and so many things took place in history right at the beginning of 5000 years. Achmatat, the Crusades took place then. The Ramban actually, is it Ramban or Rabbeinu Bechai? One of them says, I believe it's Ramban, actually says that there's going to be a nation, and I don't know how to say this, I could hear your theories. He says, because an animal is a more formed than the bird and the fish, it's already something which is a kind of a wild animal, something which is bigger and stronger. And he says that there's going to be a nation that's going to pop up and persecute the Jewish people at the beginning of the year 5000, which is going to be the worst, but also going to be the closest to the truth. Which is very, very fascinating. And I have my thoughts on this. There's going to be a nation that's going to, and there, you have to understand the context of when they're writing this, and they are writing this in the year, Rabbeinu Bechai is writing this in the year 5052, I believe. So he's literally at the beginning of that period. He doesn't even know what's going to play out. But he's saying that if animals are created all the way at the beginning of daybreak, before daybreak, right before it started, that means that there's going to come out a force even worse than the persecutions that we had from 4,000 to 5,000. But on the other hand, that force that will come out is going to be closer to the truth. I think we should think about it. You could let me know your suggestions. I have my thoughts on this, but you could take it in a few different ways. What do you say?
Christianity.
Possibly, right? Possibly Christianity.
But Islam is a lot closer to the truth than Christianity, though.
Yes.
I'm talking about in terms of violence and murder.
In the pogroms that we went through, mm-hmm. Right? I was thinking about Adam Yosef was saying, of Islam being closer.
Yeah.
The beginning. Of Arab, you know, that part of it, that part of our history is going to be, is, you know, their belief system in a way is closer. We have to think about it. I don't want to say a defined thing because it's one of the things that the Ramban says in the beginning of his commentary on the Torah is he says, I'm going to reveal to you a lot of hidden things. And he says, I'm warning you, don't say theories. Have a teacher who will tell you what I mean. Don't open the book and theorize, you know, I wonder what I mean. Because he says, if you do that, you won't get it. So I'm always very nervous to say a theory about what a Ramban means, unless I've heard it from a teacher of mine or something that is clearly, you know, you can't miss it. But something like this, you know, we could say our theories and it's fascinating to think about. Is it these two things that we mentioned? Is it other things? But either way, the beginning of 5000 was a terrible period for the Jewish people. But here comes the good news and the bad news. Adam was created a tenth of the way into the day. Adam was created a tenth of the day into day six. Now, they're writing this before that time period has come. A tenth of the day means 100 years. And the Rishonim write, according to our calculation, and we believe everything until now has taken place perfectly, everything is lined up, day 1,000, 2,000, everything is lined up perfectly. And they say, which means that Mashiach will be coming in the year 5,000, around 5,100, 5,100. They actually give a date and they say, according to specific calculations, 5,118 is the year that they both give. Ramban and Rabbeinu Bechai, they both say that that should be the year for Mashiach. Because Adam was born, and Adam, as we mentioned, who came out of Adam? David. Who came out of David? Who will come out of David? Mashiach. Adam, David, Mashiach. Which means that if Adam is born, Mashiach should be born. If Mashiach should be born, he should come. And therefore, he should come a tenth of the way into the day as soon as he's born. And in the year 5118 should be Mashiach. And they're writing this before it happened, and they have complete faith that this is what will happen. Now, we know today that we are in the year 5783, and we are 600, and don't catch me on this one, we are 665 years past that date, and Mashiach has not come. So what does that tell us? Well, we could think about this in many different ways, but this is what they say. Mashiach should have been here from the year 5118 and on. And we are many, many hundreds of years later, Mashiach still didn't come. So what this reminds me of is a Gemara, which I don't have on the sheet over here. But there's a Gemara in the Talmud in Sanhedrin says that one of the sages met Mashiach, whatever that means, and asked Mashiach, when are you coming? So Mashiach responded and said, I'm coming today. So the sage looks at him and says, you didn't come today. What do you mean you're coming today? So he responded with a quote from a verse in the Torah where it says, today, if you listen to my voice, which means that if we follow the mitzvahs well enough, if we keep the commandments well enough, the Mashiach is ready to come today. So what's holding back Mashiach from coming is not Mashiach, it's us. Maybe it's not us, maybe it's other people. But it's humanity is holding Mashiach back from coming. But if you ask Mashiach, when are you coming? His answer is always going to be the same. He says, I'm coming today. And it's very easy to understand because he was supposed to be here. He's literally been waiting at our door for 665 years to come. So we don't need to say, how can you know? People question. If you look around in the world, then how is this world going to be the harbinger for Mashiach? How on earth is that going to happen? The answer is very simple. Because he's ready here, and maybe he has to come back in many different souls and keep on coming back into this world. But the same way our persecutions were predicted and they took place to the latter, the same way every other time period in history took place, Adam was born a tenth of the way into the day. That means that Mashiach is here and he's literally at our doorstep waiting for us to allow him into the door. But we don't have to worry about how can Mashiach come. Mashiach can come because he's here. He's been here from sunrise. That's when he was supposed to come. And God willing, we'll get into, we have a few minutes, I'll get to you in a minute. I would want to say a short note on day 7. But day 6, I think, is amazing to think about, to contemplate how the Rishonim were writing this before it happened. But in their mind, this is what happened on day 6. This is what's going to play out in the year 5,000 to 6,000, up to the point that they're willing to make a calculation. And we have to believe that all that happened, when they write that Mashiach was supposed to come in 5118, that means that his revelation has been ready for us since the year 5118. And all we need to do is allow him into the door. Now I'll take your question.
This is 1328 happens to be in the current calendar, which is the actual answer to this is that the people of Scotland became independent. And that's your answer, and so it must be Sean Connery.
Very good. I have Scottish roots. My grandfather was from Scotland. So, I like that. There is actually there is a Chasim Sofer. There's a responsive in the Chasim Sofer where he writes scary words, which I wouldn't really repeat, and I may not repeat, but he basically says that Ramban was so desperate for Mashiach that he made his calculation for 5118, but he says the point that he's, in his mind is not lining up, is that in Judaism, in the Torah, the day always starts from the night. The day always starts, means it's always night, and then the Jewish day always starts at night. Doesn't start in the day. Doesn't start in the morning. Starts at night. So tonight, let's say around 8 o'clock is when the next day is going to start. So if you make a calculation based on that, if Adam was born sunrise, he really was born pretty much halfway through the day, which means that Mashiach should not be coming in 5118, but he should be coming at around 5500, 5600, which is closer, but still didn't happen. Chasam Sofer he managed to move it maybe by 500 years, but either way, whichever way you want to go about this, At this point of our history, the year that we're in today, Mashiach is ready and waiting. That has to be. That has to be the case. Let us get to day seven. Let us get to day seven. We have 4 minutes left. So, day seven, God rested. What happens during the year 6,000 to 7,000? Mashiach will have been here already. Keep in mind, by the way, that if Mashiach comes in the year 5783, God willing, we will have Mashiach for, how long are we going to be able to have the world in a messianic state for? We're going to have it for, you know, 200 and till the end of 6,000. After the once 6,000 comes, everything goes to rest. Everything ceases. Everything's going to stop. Everything's going to stop to exist.
But don't the Nevi'im say that we get 1,000 years of Shalom? That's one of the
1,000 years of?
1,000 years of peace that would be after.
So that's a good question. That's a very good question. There's,
the Nevi'im are very particular. There's a very serious requirements that,
to what it needs to be. Right, there's another verse that is in Tehillim, which says that, which seems to indicate that the years of Mashiach are going to be equal to the years of persecution that we've had. And if you do the math, that is literally impossible. Because the amount of years that the Jews have been persecuted for, we're going to have good times equivalent to those bad times. And there's no way for it to happen. So that's a whole thing unto itself, but in short, the answer is that it's possible to have, at least in quality of time, it's possible to have many, many good years taking place in a very short period of time. But once Mashiach comes, maybe time is going to look a little different than the way we have it now. And it's possible you can have 1,000 years of goodness, which will all take place possibly in 1 minute. But just food for thought, not something that I've really explained. What is the meaning that the world is going to cease to exist? And that has to do with Shabbos. Let me say one point on this. What happens on the day of Shabbos? Shabbos is what we call a day of blessing. It's a day of rest, and it's also what we say is a day of blessing. Makar, it's the source of blessing. Now, we receive the manna. We got the man on every day of the week. There was one day of the week when the man did not fall. What day was that? Shabbos. Now, if we would have to do the system, we would say that Shabbos is the day when the most man should fall. If you're telling me that Shabbos is a day of blessing, right, we should have an outpouring of man on Shabbos. So the Zohar, the Holy Zohar, asks this question. And the Zohar answers that Shabbos is not a day of blessing. Shabbos is a day where we go up to the source of where blessing comes from. That means 6 days of the week we live down here in this world, things come down to us. If we never go to the bank and withdraw the cash, we're not going to have the cash in our pockets for the other 6 days of the week. There's got to be one day where you go back to where everything's coming from and reconnect with your source, and then you could take that back with you for the rest of the week. Shabbos, what we say in Lechadodi, is Kihima Kor HaBracha, the source of blessing. Shabbos is when we go to the bank. Shabbos is the day when we go up almost out of this world, up to our source, and connect with Hashem, and go to where all blessing comes from. Then after Shabbos, we come down with a package of goodies, which is why Judaism places such a focus on keeping Shabbos. Because without Shabbos in our lives, the cash is going to run out. Without going back once a week and connecting to where everything's coming from, we're not going to be able to bring back our goodies for the week. So Shabbos is not a day where this world comes is dominant. Shabbos is a day where we lift ourselves out of this world and go to a place where everything is coming from so that we can then come back with a package for the week. So in the year 6,000, this world's going to stop because we are all going to go up to the source. And after having been recharged from all these 6,000 years of history, the ups and the downs, the highs and the lows, the persecutions, the buildings, the destructions, we're going to have 1,000 years of being plugged into our charger during that 1,000 years, which will allow us to come back after that into a state of renewed world, which is the world the way we know it, not the way we know it, the world as we're told, which is called the world to come. So for 1,000 years, we're going to go and get ourselves ready to be able to come back into a renewed world, which is going to transition from this world as we have it now into the world to come. Those are my thoughts for the day. Thank you. Thank you all.